Books on Tape presents Treasure of Khan by Clive Cussler and Dirk Cussler. Read by Scott Brick. The Emperor's Tempest, August 10th, 1281 AD, Hakata Bay, Japan. Eric Timur peered into the darkness and tilted his head toward the side rail as the sound of oars dipping through the water grew louder. When the noise closed within a few feet, he slouched back into the shadows, pulling his head down low. This time the intruders would be welcomed aboard warmly, he thought with grim anticipation. The slapping of the oars ceased, but a wooden clunk told him the small boat had pulled alongside the larger vessel's stern. The midnight moon was a slim crescent, but crystal-clear skies amplified the starlight, bathing the ship in a cottony luminance. Timur knelt quietly as he watched a dark figure climb over the stern rail, followed by another, then another, until nearly a dozen men stood on the deck. The intruders wore brightly colored silk garments under tunics of layered leather armor that rustled as they moved. But it was the glint of their razor-sharp katanas, single-edged dueling swords, that caught his eye as they assembled. With the trap set and the bait taken, the Mongol commander turned to a boy at his side and nodded. The boy immediately began ringing a heavy bronze bell he cradled in his arms, the metallic clang shattering the still night air. The invaders froze in their tracks, startled by the sudden alarm. Then a hidden mass of 30 armed soldiers sprang silently from the shadows. Armed with iron-tipped spears, they flung themselves at the invaders, thrusting their weapons with deadly fury. Half of the boarders were killed instantly, struck by multiple spear tips that skewered their body armor. The remaining invaders wielded their swords and tried to fight back, but were quickly overpowered by the mass of defenders. Within seconds, all of the boarders lay dead or dying on the ship's deck. All, that is, except a lone, standing dervish. Clad in an embroidered red silk robe with baggy trousers tucked into bearskin boots, he was clearly no peasant soldier. With devastating speed and accuracy, he surprised the attacking defenders by turning and running right into them, deflecting spear thrusts with quick waves of his sword. In an instant, he closed on a group of three of the ship's defenders and quickly dropped them all to the deck with a flash of his sword, nearly cutting one man in two with a single swipe of the blade. Watching the whirlwind decimate his soldiers, Timur jumped to his feet and unsheathed his own sword, then leaped forward. The swordsman saw Timur charge at him and deftly parried a spear thrust aside before whirling around and plunging his bloodied sword in the path of the oncoming warrior. The Mongol commander had killed more than 20 men in his lifetime and calmly sidestepped the swinging blade. The sword tip whisked by his chest, missing the skin by millimeters. As his opponent's sword passed, Timur raised his own blade and thrust it tip first into the attacker's side. The invader stiffened as the blade tore through his ribcage and bisected his heart. He bowed weakly at the Mongol as his eyes rolled back, then he fell over dead. The defenders let out a cheer that echoed across the harbor, letting the rest of the assembled Mongol invasion fleet know that the guerrilla attack this night had failed. "You fought bravely," Timur complimented his soldiers, mostly Chinese, who gathered around him. "Throw the bodies of the Japanese into the sea and let us wash their blood from our decks. We may sleep well and proud tonight." Amid another cheer, Timur knelt next to the samurai and pried away the blood-stained sword clasped in the dead man's hands. In the dim light of the ship's lanterns, he carefully studied the Japanese weapon, admiring its fine craftsmanship and razor-sharp edge before sliding it into his own waist scabbard with a nod of satisfaction. As the dead were unceremoniously dumped over the side, Timur was approached by the ship's captain, a stern Korean named Yan. A fine battle, Jan said without empathy. But how many more attacks on my ship must I endure? The land offensive will regain momentum once the south of the Yangtze fleet arrives. The enemy will soon be crushed and these raiding attacks will cease. Perhaps our entrapment of the enemy tonight will prove to be a deterrent. Jan grunted in skepticism. My ship and crew were to have been back in Pusan by now. The invasion is turning into a debacle. While the arrival of the two fleets should have been better coordinated, there is no question as to the ultimate outcome. Conquest shall be ours, Timur replied testily. As the captain walked away shaking his head, Timur cursed under his breath. Reliant on a Korean ship and crew and an army of Chinese foot soldiers with which to do battle was like having his hands tied behind his back. Land a division of Mongol cavalry, he knew, and the island nation would be subdued in a week. Wishing would not make it so, and he begrudgingly considered the validity of the captain's words. The invasion had, in fact, started off on a shaky footing, and, if he was superstitious, he might even think there was a curse on them. When Kublai, Emperor of China and Khan of Khans of the Mongol Empire, had requested tribute from Japan and been rebuffed, it was only natural to send an invasion fleet to subdue their insolence. But the invasion fleet sent in 1274 was much too small. Before a secure beachhead could be established, a severe gale battered the Mongol fleet, decimating the warships as they stood out at sea. Now, 7 years later, the same mistake would not be made. Kublai Khan called for a massive invasion force, combining elements of the Korean Eastern Fleet with the main battle group from China, the south of the Yangtze Fleet. Over 150,000 Chinese and Mongol soldiers would converge on the southern Japanese island of Kyushu to overrun the ragtag warlords defending the country. But the invasion force had yet to be consolidated. The Eastern Fleet sailing from Korea had arrived first. Pining for glory, they tried landing forces north of Hakata Bay, but quickly ground down. In the face of a spirited Japanese defense, they were forced to pull back and wait for the Second Fleet to arrive. With growing confidence, the Japanese warriors began taking the fight to the Mongol fleet. Brazen raiding parties on small boats would sneak into the harbor at night and assault the Mongol ships at anchor. The gruesome discovery of decapitated bodies told the story of yet another attack by samurai warriors, who took the heads of their slain victims home as war trophies. After several guerrilla strikes, the invasion fleet began tying their ships together for protective safety. Timur's entrapment ploy of mooring his ship alone at the edge of the bay had worked as anticipated, enticing a Japanese boarding party to their death. Though the late-night attacks caused little strategic harm, they dampened the fading morale of the invading forces. The soldiers were still stationed aboard the cramped Korean ships nearly 3 months after departing Pusan. Provisions were low. The ships were rotting, and dysentery outbreaks were cropping up across the fleet. But Timur knew that the arrival of the south of the Yangtze ships would turn the tables. The experienced and disciplined force from China would easily defeat the lightly organized samurai warriors once they were landed en masse. If only they would arrive. The next morning broke sunny and clear, with a stiff breeze blowing from the south. On the stern of his Mugun support ship, Captain Yan surveyed the crowded confines of Hakata Bay. The fleet of Korean ships was an impressive sight in its own right. Nearly 900 vessels stretched across the bay in an assortment of shapes and sizes. Most were wide and sturdy junks, some as small as 20 feet, others, like Jan's, stretching nearly 80 feet long. Almost all had been constructed purposely for the invasion. But the Eastern Fleet, as it was known, would be dwarfed by the forces to come. At 3:30 in the afternoon, a call rang out from a lookout, and soon excited cries and the sound of banging drums thundered across the harbor. Out to sea, the first dots of the southern invasion force appeared on the horizon, crawling toward the Japanese coast. Hour by hour, the dots multiplied and grew larger until the entire sea seemed to be a mass of dark wooden ships with blood-red sails. More than 3,000 ships carrying 100,000 additional soldiers emerged from the Korea Strait, comprising an invasion fleet the likes of which would not be seen again until the invasion of Normandy almost 700 years later. The red silk sails of the war fleet flapped across the horizon like a crimson squall. All night and well into the following day, squadron after squadron of Chinese junks approached the coast, assembling in and around Hakata Bay as the military commanders calculated a landing strike. Signal flags rose high on the flagship where Mongol and Chinese generals planned a renewed invasion. Behind the defenses of their stone seawall, the Japanese looked on in horror at the massive fleet. The overwhelming odds seemed to heighten the determination in some of the defenders. Others looked on in despair and desperately prayed for the gods to help through heavenly intervention. Even the most fearless samurai recognized that there was little likelihood they would survive the assault. But 1,000 miles to the south, another force was at work, more powerful even than the invasion fleet of Kublai Khan. A percolating mix of wind and sea and rain was brewing together, welding into a wicked mass of energy. The storm had formed, as most typhoons do, in the warm waters of the western Pacific near the Philippines. An isolated thunderstorm set off its berth, upsetting the surrounding high-pressure front by causing warm air to converge with cold. Funneling warm air off the ocean's surface, the churning winds gradually blew into a tempest. Moving unabated across the sea, the storm grew in intensity, exuding a devastating force of wind. Surface winds raged higher and higher until exceeding 160 miles per hour. The super typhoon, as they are now branded, crept almost straight north before curiously shifting directions to the northeast. Directly in its path were the southern islands of Japan and the Mongol fleet. Standing off Kyushu, the assembled invasion force was focused only on conquest. Oblivious to the approaching tempest, the joint fleets assembled for a combined invasion. "We are ordered to join the deployments to the south," Captain Yan reported to Timur after signal flags were exchanged within his squadron. "Preliminary ground forces have landed and secured a harbor for unloading the troops. We are to follow portions of the Yangtze fleet out of Hakata Bay and prepare to land our soldiers as reinforcements." "It will be a relief to have my soldiers on dry land again," Timur replied. Like all Mongols, Timur was a land warrior used to fighting on horseback. Attacking from the sea was a relatively novel concept for the Mongols, adopted only in recent years by the emperor as a necessary means of subjugating Korea and South China. "You shall have your chance to land and fight soon enough," Yan replied as he oversaw the retrieval of his ship's stone anchor. Following the main body of the fleet out of Hakata Bay and along the coastline to the south, Yan looked uncomfortably at the skies as they blackened on the horizon. A single cloud seemed to grow larger and larger until it shaded the entire sky. As darkness fell, the wind and seas began to seethe, while sprays of rain slapped hard against the ship's surface. Many of the Korean captains recognized the signs of an approaching squall and repositioned their ships farther offshore. The Chinese sailors, not as experienced in open water conditions, foolishly held their positions close to the landing site. Unable to sleep in his rollicking bunk, Timur climbed above deck to find eight of his men clinging to the rail, seasick from the turbulence. The pitch-black night was broken by dozens of tiny lights that danced above the waves, small candle-lit lanterns that marked other vessels of the fleet. Many of the ships were still tied together, and Timur watched as small clusters of candlelight rose and fell as one on the rolling swells. "I will be unable to land your troops ashore," Jan shouted to Timur over the howling winds. "The storm is still building. We must move out to sea in order to avoid being crushed on the rocks." Timur made no effort to protest and simply nodded his head. Though he wanted nothing more than to get his soldiers and himself off the pitching ship, he knew an attempt to do so would be foolhardy. Jan was right. As miserable as the prospect sounded, there was nothing to do but ride out the storm. Jan ordered the lugsail on the foremast raised and maneuvered the ship's bow to the west. Tossing roughly through the growing waves, the sturdy vessel slowly began fighting its way away from the coastline. Around Jan's vessel, confusion reigned with the rest of the fleet. Several of the Chinese ships attempted to put troops ashore in the maelstrom, though most remained at anchor a short distance away. A scattering of vessels, mostly from the Eastern Fleet, followed Jan's lead and began repositioning themselves offshore. Few seemed to believe that yet another typhoon could strike and damage the fleet as in 1274, but the doubters were soon to be proven wrong. The super typhoon gathered force and rolled closer, bringing with it a torrent of wind and rain. Soon after dawn, the sky turned black and the storm reared up with its full might. Torrential rains blew horizontally, the water pellets bursting with enough force to shred the sails of the bobbing fleet. Waves crashed to shore in thunderous blows that could be heard miles away. With screeching winds that exceeded a Category 4 hurricane, the super typhoon finally crashed into Kyushu. On shore, the Japanese defenders were subject to a 10-foot wall of storm surge that pounded over the shoreline, inundating homes, villages, and defense works while drowning hundreds. Ravaging winds uprooted ancient trees and sent loose debris flying through the air like missiles. A continuous deluge of rain dumped a foot of water an hour on inland areas, flooding valleys and overflowing rivers in a deadly barrage. Flash floods and mudslides killed untold more, burying whole towns and villages in seconds. But the maelstrom on shore paled in comparison to the fury felt by the Mongol fleet at sea. In addition to the explosive winds and piercing rains came mammoth waves blown high by the storm's wrath. Rolling mountains of water belted the invasion fleet, capsizing many vessels while smashing others to bits. Ships anchored close to shore were swiftly blown into the rocky shoals, where they were battered into small pieces. Timbers buckled and beams splintered from the force of the waves, causing dozens of ships to simply disintegrate in the boiling seas. In Hakata Bay, groups of ships still lashed together were battered mercilessly. As one vessel foundered, it would pull the other ships to the bottom like a string of dominoes. Trapped inside the fast-sinking ships, the crew and soldiers died a quick death. Those escaping to the violent surface waters drowned a short time later, as few knew how to swim. Aboard the Korean Mugun, Timur and his men clung desperately to the ship as it was tossed like a cork in a washing machine. Jan expertly guided the vessel through the teeth of the storm, fighting to keep his bow to the waves. Several times the wooden ship heeled so far over that Timur thought she would capsize. Yet there was Jan standing tall at the rudder as the ship righted itself, a determined grin on his face as he did battle with the elements. It wasn't until a monster 40-foot wave suddenly appeared out of the gloom that the salty captain turned pale. The huge wall of water bore down on them with a thunderous roar. The cresting waves swept onto the ship like an avalanche, burying the vessel in a froth of sea and foam. For several seconds, the Korean ship disappeared completely under the raging sea. Men below decks felt their stomachs drop from the force of the plunge and oddly noted the howl of the wind vanish as everything went black. By all rights, the wooden ship should have broken to pieces by the waves pounding. But the tough little vessel held together. As the giant wave rolled past, the ship rose like an apparition from the deep and regained her position on the frenzied sea. Timur was tossed across the deck during the submersion and barely clung to a ladder rung as the ship flooded. He gasped for air as the vessel resurfaced and was distraught to see that the masts had been torn off the ship. Behind him, a sharp cry rang out in the water off the stern. Glancing about the deck, he realized with horror that Jan and 5 Korean seamen, along with a handful of his own men, had been swept off the ship. A chorus of panicked cries pierced the air momentarily before it was washed out by the howl of the wind. Timur caught sight of the captain and men struggling nearby in the water. He could only watch helplessly as a large wave carried them from his sight. Without masts and crew, the ship was now at the complete mercy of the storm. Pitching and wallowing feebly in the seas, pounded and flooded by the high waves, the ship had 1,000 opportunities to founder. But the simple yet robust construction of the Korean ship kept her afloat while around her scores of Chinese ships vanished into the depths. After several intense, buffeting hours, the winds slowly died down and the pelting rains ceased. For a brief moment, the sun broke clear, and Timur thought the storm had ended. But it was just the eye of the typhoon passing over, offering a brief reprieve before the assault would continue again. Below decks, Timur found 2 Korean sailors still aboard and forced them to help man the ship. As the winds picked up and the rains returned, Timur and the sailors took turns tying themselves to the rudder and battling the deadly waves. Lost as to position or even the direction they sailed, the men bravely focused on keeping the ship afloat. Unaware that they were now absorbing the counterclockwise winds that swirled from the north, they were pushed rapidly through open water to the south. The brunt of the typhoon's energy had been expended as it struck Kyushu, so the battering was less intense than before. But gusts over 90 miles per hour still buffeted the vessel, blasting it roughly through the seas. Blinded by the pelting rain, Timur had little clue to their path. Several times the ship nearly approached landfall, inching by islands, rocks, and shoals that went unseen in the gloom of the storm. Miraculously, the ship blew clear, the men aboard never realizing how close they came to death. The typhoon raged day and night before gradually losing its power, the rain and winds fading to a light squall. The Korean Mugun, battered and leaky, held fast and clung to the surface with gritty pride. Though the captain and crew were lost and the ship was a crippled mess, they had survived all that the killer storm could throw at them. A quiet sense of luck and destiny settled over them as the seas began to calm. No such luck befell the rest of the Mongol invasion force, which was brutally decimated by the killer typhoon. Nearly the entire Yangtze fleet was destroyed, smashed to bits against the rocky shoreline, or sunk by the vicious seas. a jumbled array of broken timber from huge Chinese junks, Korean warships, and oar-driven barges littered the shoreline. In the water, the cries of the dying had long since echoed over the shrieks of the wind. Many of the soldiers, clothed in heavy leather body armor, sank immediately to the bottom upon being cast in the waves. Others fought through the throes of panic to stay afloat, only to be pummeled by the endless onslaught of massive waves. The lucky few who crawled ashore alive were quickly caught up by marauding bands of samurai roving the shoreline. After the storm, the dead littered the beaches like stacked cords of wood. Half-sunken wrecks lined the horizon off Kyushu in such numbers that it was said a man could walk across the Imari Gulf without getting wet. The remnants of the invasion fleet limped back to Korea and China with the unthinkable news that Mother Nature had again spoiled the Mongol plans of conquest. It was a crushing defeat for Kublai Khan. The disaster represented the worst defeat suffered by the Mongols since the reign of Genghis Khan and showed the rest of the world that the forces of the great empire were far from invincible. For the Japanese, the arrival of the killer typhoon was nothing less than a miracle. Despite the destruction incurred on Kyushu, the island had been spared conquest and the invading forces defeated. Most believed it could only have come as a result of the 11th-hour prayers to the sun goddess at the shrine of Ise. Divine intervention had prevailed, a sure sign that Japan was blessed with heavenly protection to ward off foreign invaders. So strong was the belief in the kamikaze, or divine wind as it was called, that it permeated Japanese history for centuries, reappearing as the appellation for the suicide pilots of World War II. Aboard the Korean troop ship, Timur and the surviving crew had no idea as to the devastation suffered by the invasion fleet. Blown out to sea, they could only assume that the invading force would regroup after the storm passed and continue the assault. "We must rejoin the fleet," Timur told the men. "The Emperor is expecting victory, and we must fulfill our duty." There was only one problem. After 3 days and nights of severe weather, tossed about without mast and sails, there was no telling where they were. The weather cleared, but there were no other ships in sight. Worse for Timur, there was nobody aboard capable of navigating a vessel at sea. The two Korean sailors who survived the storm were a cook and an aged ship's carpenter, neither possessing navigation skills. "The land of Japan must be to the east of us," he conferred with the Korean carpenter. "Construct a new mast and sails, and we shall use the sun and stars to guide us east until we reach landfall and relocate the invasion fleet." The old carpenter argued that the ship was not seaworthy.
"She is battered and leaking.
We must sail northwest to Korea to save ourselves," he cried. But Timur would have none of it. A temporary mast was hastily constructed and makeshift sails raised. With a fresh determination, the Mongol soldier-turned-sailor guided the waylaid ship toward the eastern horizon, anxious to put ashore again and rejoin the battle. 2 days passed, and all Timur and his men could see was blue water. The Japanese mainland never materialized. Thoughts of changing course were dispelled when yet another storm crept up on them from the southwest. Though less intense than the earlier typhoon, the tropical storm was widespread and slow-moving. For 5 days, the troop ship battled the throes of high winds and heavy rains that pitched them wildly about the ocean. The beaten ship seemed to be reaching its limits. The temporary mast and sails were again lost overboard to the gales, while leaks below the waterline kept the carpenter working around the clock. More disconcerting, the entire rudder broke free of the ship, taking with it two of Timur's soldiers, who clung to it for dear life. When it seemed that the ship could bear no more, the second storm quietly passed. But as the weather eased, the men aboard became more anxious than ever. Land had not been sighted in over a week, and food supplies were beginning to dwindle. Men openly pleaded with Timur to sail the ship to China, but the prevailing winds and current, as well as the lack of a ship's rudder, made that impossible. The lone ship was adrift in the ocean with no bearings, no navigation aids, and little means to guide the way. Timur lost track of time as the hours drifted into days and the days into weeks. With their provisions depleted, the feeble crew resorted to catching fish for food and collecting rainwater for drinking. The gray, stormy weather was gradually replaced by clear skies and sunny weather. As the winds tapered, the temperature warmed. The ship seemed to grow stagnant along with the crew, drifting aimlessly under light winds over a flat sea. Soon a death cloud began to hover over the vessel. Each sunrise brought the discovery of a new corpse as the starving crewmen began to perish in the night. Timur looked over his emaciated soldiers with a feeling of dishonor. Rather than die in battle, their fate was to starve on an empty ocean far from home. As the men around him dozed in the midday sun, a sudden clamor erupted on the port side deck of the ship. "It's a bird," someone cried. "Try to kill it." Timur lurched to his feet to see a trio of men attempting to surround a large, dark-billed seagull. The bird hopped around spastically, eyeing the hungry men with a wary look. One of the men grabbed a wooden mallet with a gnarled, sunburned hand and flung it swiftly at the bird, hoping to stun or kill it. The gull deftly sidestepped the flying mallet and, with a loud squawk of indignation, flapped its wings and rose lazily into the sky. While the disgruntled men cursed, Timur quietly studied the gull, his eyes following the white bird as it flew south and gradually melted into the horizon. Squinting at the far line of blue where the water met the sky, he suddenly arched a brow. Blinking forcefully, he looked again, tensing slightly when his eyes registered a small green lump on the horizon. Then his nose joined in on the fantasy. Timur could smell a difference in the air. The damp, salt air that his lungs had become used to now had a different aroma. A sweet, slightly flowery fragrance wafted through his nostrils. Taking a deep breath, he cleared his throat and grumbled to the men on the deck. "There is land before us," he said in a parched voice, pointing toward the path of the gull. "Let every man who is able help guide us to it." The exhausted and emaciated crew staggered to life at the words. After straining their eyes at the distant speck on the horizon, the men gathered their wits and went to work. A large deck support beam was sawed loose and manhandled over the stern, where, secured with ropes, it would act as a crude rudder. While three men wrestled the beam about to steer the ship, the remaining men attacked the water. Brooms, boards, and even sabers were used as makeshift oars by the desperate men in a struggle to row the battered vessel to land. Slowly, the distant spot grew larger until a shimmering emerald island materialized, complete with a broad, towering mountain peak. Approaching the shoreline, they found heaving waves battering a rocky coastline, which rose up vertically. In a panicked moment, the ship became caught in a cross current that drove them toward an inlet surrounded by jagged boulders. "Rocks ahead!" the old ship's carpenter cried, eyeing the protrusions off the bow. "Every man to the left side of the ship!" Timur bellowed as they bore down on a dark wall of rock. The half-dozen men on the starboard railing ran, scampered, and crawled to the port side and frantically slapped the water with their makeshift oars. Their last-second surge nosed the bow away from the rocks, and the men held their breath as the port hull scraped against a line of submerged boulders. The grinding ceased, and the men realized that the ship's timbers had held together once more.
"There is no place to put ashore here," the carpenter shouted. "We must turn and go back to sea."
Timur peered at the sheer rock cliff rising above the shore. Porous black and gray rocks stretched in a high, jagged wall in front of them, broken only by the small black oval of a cave, cut off their port bow at the waterline.
"Bring the bow around. Row again, men, at a steady pace."
Clawing at the water, the drained men propelled the boat away from the rocks and back into the offshore current. Drifting along the landmass, they saw that the towering shoreline eventually softened. Finally, the carpenter spat out the words the crew waited to hear.
"We can land her there," he said,
pointing to a large crescent-shaped cove cut into the shoreline. Timur nodded, and the men guided the vessel toward shore, a final gust of energy flowing from their limbs. Paddling into the cove, the exhausted men drove the ship toward a sandy beach until its barnacle-encrusted hull ground to a halt a few feet from shore. The weary men were nearly too spent to climb off the ship. Grabbing his sword, Timur painfully staggered ashore with 5 men to search for food and fresh water. Following the sound of rushing water, they cut through a thicket of tall ferns and found a freshwater lagoon, fed by a waterfall that rushed down a rocky ledge. In jubilance, Timur and his men plunged into the lagoon and happily gulped down mouthfuls of the cool water. Their enjoyment was short-lived when a sudden pounding broke the air. It was the boom of the signal drum aboard the Korean ship, thumping out a cry to battle. Timur sprung to his feet in a single motion and called immediately to his men.
"Back to the ship! At once!"
He didn't wait for his men to assemble, but vaulted ahead in the direction of the ship. Whatever pain and weakness his legs had felt before vanished under the replenishment of fresh water and the surge of adrenaline rushing through his body. Bounding through the jungle, he could hear the drumbeat's decibels rise in his ears as he moved closer until he finally burst past a cluster of palm trees and onto the sandy beach. The veteran soldier's eyes quickly scanned the surrounding waters and immediately spotted the source of the alarm. Midway across the cove, a narrow canoe sailed toward the grounded ship. Seated inside, a half-dozen shirtless men rhythmically muscled spade-shaped wooden paddles through the water, driving the canoe swiftly toward shore. Timur noted the men's skin was colored a deep bronze, and most had curly black hair kept shorter than his own. Several of the men wore necklaces with a hook-shaped bone dangling across their chests.
"Your orders, sir?"
asked a frail soldier who had been banging the drum, finally ceasing the alarm. Timur hesitated before answering, knowing that a harem of old maids could defeat his emaciated crew in their present state.
"Arm with spears," he ordered calmly.
"Defensive line behind me on the beach." The surviving remnants of his command staggered off the boat and out of the jungle, lining up behind Timur with the few remaining spears still aboard. The ragged force had little strength left, but Timur knew they would die fighting for him if necessary. He felt for the grip of the Japanese samurai sword he now wore at his belt and wondered if he would die with its blade in his hand. The canoe made its way directly toward the men on the beach, its rowers silent as they propelled the boat to shore. When the bow scraped the sand at the water's edge, the occupants jumped out and quickly dragged the canoe onto the beach, then stood solemnly alongside the craft. For several seconds, the two parties eyed each other suspiciously. Finally, one of the men from the canoe crossed the sand and stood before Timur. He was short, barely 5 foot tall, and older than the rest, with long white hair wrapped with a bark strip into a ponytail. He wore a string of shark's teeth around his neck and gripped a wooden staff made from twisted driftwood. His brown eyes sparkled with luster, and he smiled broadly at the Mongol, displaying a crooked row of bright white teeth. In a melodic language, he spoke rapidly, offering what seemed to be a non-threatening greeting. Timur simply nodded slightly, keeping a sharp eye on the other men by the canoe. The old man jabbered for several minutes, then abruptly returned to the canoe and reached inside. Timur tightened his grip on the Japanese sword and gave his men a knowing look of caution. But he relaxed when the old man stood and held up a fat 30-pound yellowfin tuna. The other natives reached into the canoe and retrieved other fish and shellfish carried in reed baskets, which they placed at the feet of Timur's men. The famished soldiers anxiously waited for approval from the Mongol leader, then voraciously attacked the food, smiling thanks to the native hosts. The old man strode up to Timur and offered him a drink of water from a pigskin bag. Having gained mutual trust, the natives pointed into the jungle and motioned for the shipwrecked men to follow. Hesitantly leaving their ship, Timur and his men followed the natives through the jungle, hiking for a mile or two before entering a small clearing. Several dozen small thatch-covered huts surrounded a fenced corral where small children were playing with a herd of pigs. On the opposite side of the clearing, an even larger hut with a high roof served as the home of the village chief, who Timur was surprised to learn was none other than the old white-haired man. The residents of the village gawked at the strangers as a feast was hastily prepared and the Asian warriors welcomed into the community with great honor. The ship, clothes, and weapons of the strangers were evidence of great knowledge, and the men were prized surreptitiously as new allies against potential enemy combatants. The Chinese and Korean warriors were simply glad to be alive and welcomed the generous offers of food, housing, and female companionship that the friendly villagers extended. Only Timur accepted the hospitality with reservation. As he chewed on a slab of grilled abalone with the village chief, his men around him enjoying themselves for the first time in weeks, he silently wondered if he would ever see Mongolia again. Over the next few weeks, the men of the Mongol invasion force took up residence in the village, gradually assimilating into the community. Initially, Timur refused to settle in the camp, sleeping in the rotting ship each night. Only when the storm-ravaged hull timbers finally gave way and the battered remains of the ship slid to the bottom of the cove did he reluctantly move to the village. Thoughts of his wife and 4 children played in his mind, but with the ship ruined, Timur began to give up hope of returning home. His crew had gladly accepted their new lives on the tropical outpost, viewing their station as far preferable to the bleak life in China as soldiers of the Mongol Emperor. It was an attitude Timur could never accept. The scrappy Mongol commander was a loyal servant to the Khan and knew it was his duty to return to service at the first opportunity. But with his ship in pieces at the bottom of the cove, there was no viable means of returning home. With a bitter reluctance, Timur gradually resigned himself to a castaway's life on the large island. The years trickled by and gradually softened the resolve of the old warrior. Over time, Timur and his men had learned the lyrical native tongue of the island community, and the Mongol commander enjoyed swapping adventure tales with the white-haired chief. Mahu, as he was called, bantered on about how his ancestors had sailed an epic voyage across the Great Sea just a few generations before in mammoth sailing ships. The island had called to them, he said, with a rumble and a billow of smoke from the mountaintop, a sign of welcome from the gods to come and prosper. The gods had smiled on them ever since, providing a land of temperate weather and abundant food and water. Timur chuckled at the description, wondering how the primitive natives who barely traversed to neighboring islands in small canoes could find their way to crossing the ocean itself. "I would like to see one of these majestic sailing ships," he chided the old man.
"I will take you to one," Mahu replied indignantly. "You will see for yourself."
The amused Timur saw that the old chief was serious and took him up on the offer. After a 2-day trek across the island, he was beginning to regret his curiosity when the weathered jungle path they followed suddenly opened onto a small sandy beach. Timur stopped when his feet touched the sand, and the old man silently pointed toward the far end of the beach. Timur didn't recognize it at first. Gazing across the beach, he saw only a pair of large tree trunks lying perpendicular to the shore. The rest of the beach appeared barren. As his eyes fell back to the fallen trees, he suddenly realized that they were more than just dead wood. They were the support frames for a massive raft that lay half buried in the sand. The Mongol warrior ran toward the object, not believing his eyes. With each step, he became more mesmerized. Though obviously sitting on the beach for years, perhaps even decades, the ancient sailing craft was still intact. Timur could see it was a double-hulled design with a single flat deck supported by the two large logs. The vessel stretched over 60 feet, but carried only a large single mast, which had rotted away. Though the plank deck had disintegrated, Timur could see that the massive support timbers looked as sturdy as when they were felled. There was no doubt in Timur's mind that the boat had been an ocean-going vessel. Mahu's fanciful tale was true after all. Timur excitedly gazed at the remains of the vessel, eyeing a means to escape the island.
"You shall return me to my home and emperor," he muttered wistfully to the wooden mass.
With a native work crew under the direction of the Korean ship's carpenter put to the task, Timur set about refitting the old sailing vessel. Deck planking was cut and fit from nearby hardwood trees. Coconut husk fibers were braided into sennit cord and tied to the hull timbers and supports. A large reed sail was woven and fitted to the replacement mast, cut from a young tree near the beach. In just a few short weeks, the nearly forgotten ocean voyager was reclaimed from the sands and made ready to ply the waves again. To sail the craft, Timur could have ordered his old crew aboard, but he knew that most were afraid to risk their lives again in a daring sea voyage. Many of the men now had wives and children on the island. When he asked for volunteers, just 3 men stepped forward, along with old Mahu. Timur could ask for no more. It would be barely enough to sail the old craft, but the Mongol commander accepted without question the decision of those who elected to stay. Provisions were stocked, and then the men waited until Mahu declared that the time was right. "The goddess Hina will offer us safe passage to the west now," he finally told Timur a week later when the winds shifted direction. "Let us be away. I shall report to the emperor of his new colony in this distant land," he shouted to the men assembled on the beach as the twin canoe hull broke through the surf and an offshore breeze launched them briskly out to sea. Loaded with plenty of water, dried fish, and fruit from the local landscape, the ships set sail with enough stores for the crew to survive for weeks at sea. As the lush, verdant island disappeared in the waves behind them, the men aboard the catamaran felt a moment of insecurity and foolishness. Their deadly struggles on the sea more than a decade earlier came flooding back, and they all wondered whether the forces of nature would allow them to survive again. Yet Timur was confident. His trust lay in the old man, Mahu. Though the native chief had little sailing experience, he had read the stars with ease and tracked the sun's movements by day while studying the clouds and sea swells. It was Mahu who knew that the winds to the south of the island turned west in the fall months, which would fill their sails with a steady breeze in the direction home. It was Mahu who also knew how to catch tuna with a line and bone hook, using flying fish for bait, which would supplement their diet during the long voyage. After landfall disappeared from sight, the sailing came surprisingly easy for the inexperienced crew. Fair skies and calm seas greeted the men each day for a fortnight as they sailed with the wind. Only an occasional squall tested the boat's sturdiness, and it also gave the crew a chance to collect fresh rainwater. All the while, Mahu calmly issued the sailing orders while constantly tracking the sun and stars. Studying the clouds on the horizon several days later, he noticed an unusual clustering to the southwest. "Land to the south! 2 days' sailing!" he proclaimed. Relief and excitement flowed through the crew at the prospect of reaching land again. But where were they, and what lands were they approaching? The next morning, a dot appeared on the horizon, which grew larger with each passing hour. It was not land, however, but another sailing vessel crossing their path. As the ship drew near, Timur could see it sported a low stern and captured the wind with triangular white sails. She was not a Chinese vessel, he knew, but looked to be an Arab merchant ship. The trader drew alongside the island catamaran and dropped its sails as a thin, dark-skinned man in a brightly colored robe shouted a greeting from the rail. Timur studied the man for a moment, then, reading no threat, climbed aboard the small sailing ship. The trading vessel was from Zanzibar, its captain a jovial Muslim merchantman with considerable experience trading goods with the royal court of the Great Khan. The ship was bound for Shanghai with a cargo of ivory, gold, and spices to be traded for fine Chinese porcelain and silk. Timur's tiny crew was welcomed aboard and sadly watched as their sturdy, double-hulled canoe was cut loose, left to drift the Pacific alone. The Muslim captain shrewdly guessed that saving the life of a Mongol commander would result in a more favored trading status, and he wasn't disappointed. Landing at the port city of Shanghai, the vessel ignited in immediate uproar. News of the soldier's appearance 13 years after the aborted invasion of Japan spread across the city like wildfire. Representatives from the government met Timur and his men and whisked them up to the imperial city at Tatu for a briefing with the emperor. Along the way, Timur quizzed his escorts about news of war and politics during his absence. Much of the news was dispiriting. The invasion of Japan had been an unmitigated disaster, he learned, the typhoon having wiped out over 2,000 ships and nearly 100,000 men. Timur was saddened to learn that his commander and many of his comrades had not returned with the remnants of the surviving fleet. Equally disturbing was the revelation that the islands of Japan still lay unconquered. Though Kublai Khan wished to attempt a third invasion, his advisors had wisely quelled the notion. In a little over a decade, the dominance of the entire empire had been shattered. After defeat in Japan, an expedition to suppress unrest in Vietnam had also met with failure, while the expense of expanding the Grand Canal to Chung Tu had nearly caused the economy to collapse. Questions about the Emperor's health created apprehension about his successor. A simmering resentment already resided in the people over the fact that a Mongol ruled the Yuan Empire. There seemed to be little dispute. Since defeating the Song Dynasty in 1279 and uniting China under a single rule, Kublai Khan's empire was now withering in a slow decline. Arriving in the capital city of Tatu, Timur and his men were led to the imperial city and escorted into the private chambers of the emperor. Though Timur had seen Kublai Khan many times in earlier years, he was shocked at the sight of the man before him now. Stretched out on a padded chaise lounge and clad in yards of silk robing was a fat, haggard man who stared through sullen black eyes. Despondent over the recent death of his favorite wife and the loss of his second son, Kublai had turned to food and drink for solace, consuming both in excess. Though he'd reached the startling age of 80, the dietary excesses were now wreaking havoc on the revered leader's health. Timur noted that the overweight Khan rested a gout-inflamed foot on a pillow, while jugs of fermented mare's milk stood at arm's length.
"Commander Timur, you have returned from a considerable absence to resume your duty," the Khan stated in a raspy voice. "As the Emperor commands," Timur replied, bowing deeply. "Tell of your voyages, Timur, and the mysterious land on which you were shipwrecked."
Carved chairs were brought for Timur and his men to sit, as the Mongol commander described the fierce typhoon that blew his ship away from the Japanese mainland and their subsequent plight adrift at sea. As cups of the alcoholic liquid were passed around, he described their luck at landing on the lush island and being welcomed by the local inhabitants. Introducing Mahu, he told of the old man's aid in sailing the large double-hulled vessel across the sea before they met up with the Muslim merchant.
"A remarkable journey," Kublai lauded. "The lands you fell upon, they were rich and fertile? Exceedingly. The soil is bountiful, and with a temperate climate subject to much rainfall, an abundance of wild and cultivated plants flourish there." "Congratulations, my emperor," said a wrinkled man with a long white beard standing at the Khan's side.
The Confucian advisor to the throne was clearly unimpressed with the tale or the audience before him.
"You have once again added new lands to the empire. Is it true you have left a garrison behind?" Kublai asked. "The lands are now under Mongol rule?"
Timur silently cursed the Confucian advisor's ploy to fabricate glory for the emperor. He knew that the men he left behind had long ago ground their swords for domestic life. Their loyalty to the Khan had been a question well before they even shipwrecked.
"Yes," Timur lied.
"A small contingent rules the land in your name." He looked at the old village chief Mahu with shame, but the old man simply nodded back, understanding the politics of the empire. Kublai gazed past the men across the room, his eyes seeing an image far beyond the walls of the palace. Timur wondered if the Mongol ruler was intoxicated from the drink.
"I should like to see this wondrous place. This land where the sun first shines on my empire," Kublai finally whispered dreamily.
"Yes, it is a near paradise on earth, as beautiful as any lands under the rain."
"You know the route back, Timur?"
"I do not know the ways of navigation at sea, but Mahu can read the sun and the stars. He could find the way back to his home in a stout ship, I believe.
You have served the Empire well, Timur. Your loyalty to the Empire shall be well rewarded,
Kublai gasped, coughing up a mouthful of liquid that sprayed over his silk tunic. Thank you, my Emperor, he replied, bowing again. A pair of palace guards suddenly materialized and escorted Timur and his men out of the Khan's chamber. The Mongol commander felt remorse as he left the palace. The great Kublai Khan was but a tired and ancient shell of the old leader who ruled one of the largest empires in world history. Much more than a bloodthirsty conqueror like his grandfather, Kublai had ruled with an enlightenment not seen before. He welcomed traders and explorers from distant lands, imposed laws that fostered religious tolerance, and promoted scientific research into geography, astronomy, and medicine. He was now near death, and the empire couldn't help but become a less inspired land without his visionary leadership. As Timur exited the Grand Palace grounds, he suddenly noticed that Mahu was not by his side. Oddly, he realized that the old villager had remained behind in the Emperor's chamber. Timur waited for him to emerge, but after several hours gave up and proceeded out of the capital city to his home, village, and family. He never again saw the old man who had led him home, and often wondered of the fate of his foreign friend. Just 2 months later, the somber news was announced of the death of the great emperor. Kublai Khan had finally succumbed to the ravages of age and alcoholism. An elaborate farewell ceremony to honor the emperor's life was held in Tatu, the city he had selected to be his primary capital. An altar would later be constructed in his honor south of the city, now known as Beijing, which still stands today. After the public services, a funeral caravan left the city, toting the coffin of the great Khan in an ornate carriage. Followed by 1,000 horses and soldiers, the solemn procession marched slowly north into Mongolia and the homeland of Kublai. At a secret spot in the Khenti Mountains, the tomb of Kublai Khan was laid to rest with a cortege of animals, concubines, and valued riches from across the empire. To ensure a peaceful afterlife, the burial region was trampled with horses to disguise the site. Construction laborers tasked with digging the tomb were executed outright, and the procession commanders sworn to secrecy under penalty of death. In a few short years, the burial site of the Mongol leader was lost to history, and the memory of Kublai Khan cast to the winds that whip tirelessly down the slopes of the green forested mountain range. 1,000 miles to the south, a large Chinese junk slipped out of its dock at Shanghai before dawn and silently drifted down the Yellow River toward the Pacific Ocean. One of just a handful of ocean-going trade ships in the Emperor's fleet, the massive junk stood over 200 feet long, carrying 12 sails on 4 tall masts. With the Yuan Empire still in mourning, the vessel didn't fly its usual state banners and, in fact, carried no identifying flags at all. Few people on shore wondered much about the early departure of the large ship, which normally set sail with great fanfare. Only a handful of onlookers noted that the vessel was manned with half its normal crew. And fewer still noticed the odd sight at the ship's helm. An old, dark-skinned man with flowing white hair stood next to the captain, pointing to the clouds and rising sun. In a strange tongue, he directed the path of the majestic vessel as it departed civilization and entered the waters of the vast blue ocean for a distant and uncharted destination.